Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan.
And welcome into Legal Face Off, the first episode of May here on WGN and WGNRadio.com. Plenty to get to, political chaos, Trump, Giuliani, and Mueller. We will meet a Chicago mayoral candidate. There's a new book out about American businesses and their civil rights. And we'll also learn about a new documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, plus the legal grab bag at the end of the show. But leading us off, he's the managing director of BRG, the Berkeley Research Group here in Chicago, and a former assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, Jeffrey Kramer. Jeff, welcome back to the Legal Face-Off.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Jeff, frequent guest on Legal Face-Off. Where do we start? The Mueller? I mean, we only have you for a few minutes because you're a busy guy and you're all over media, but where do we start? I mean, this morning, breaking news with Giuliani, who is one of the ever-evolving door of Trump lawyers, has come out and he said what? What's the news that Giuliani broke this morning?
Well, you know, it started last night. He went in and said that the $130,000 payment was made, and then it was reimbursed by Trump through a series of monthly retainer payments.
Which is a direct contrast to what Trump said. Trump has said, and his attorney throughout the course of this probe, that he had no idea about this payment. He was not involved with it. And now Giuliani just completely showed that was a lie, right? I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah, I think it is. It's an evolving pattern. I never met the woman. You know, I never paid the woman. And now we're like, oh, yes, I know her well. So the payment was made, reimbursed by Trump. And today, earlier, Rudy Giuliani also said that Cohen did his job, right? He's a fixer. He did his job. And then the comment akin to, well, we didn't want that coming out right before the election because there was a debate coming up. And right there, boom, that speaks to the payment was made with an eye towards the election, not keeping the affair secret from his wife. I'm not sure why that was even an issue given his background. So I think it really is tinker's devil's to chance. We now have a campaign violation.
Is Giuliani supposed to be helping or hurting Trump? Who hired him?
Yeah,
in the last 20 hours, he's totally screwed Trump.
He's made some news the last day. I don't think the first time out they knew what he was going to do. I can't imagine, right, he went off the rails that much. Although, again, things change quickly on the way over to the studio here. The White House is doing damage control. I can't imagine they didn't know he was going to front that. But I think it made sense. Once Cohen's offices got raided, Mueller has the documents. He's got the reimbursement payments. It's not a question. It's a document or a series of payments. So that's locked in. So there's a $130,000 campaign violation. It's not the biggest crime in the world. It's certainly not the worst thing any president's ever done, which begs the question, what else is out there?
So I don't know if you saw the Twitter madness
the
that
Twitter?
Was going
no.
in. Well, the Twitter madness, not the Twitter. Twitter, the Twitter madness.
On the World
starting
Wide
last
Web.
Night, it was amazing on the World Wide Web.
Yeah, it's people are going nuts. I mean, rightfully so. You know, you said the $130,000 violation is not the biggest crime, but like we've seen in so many of these, you know, scandals, and not to use a cliche, it's not the crime, it's the cover up. And I mean, isn't this, number one, a solid home run case of a campaign violation at the very least, and maybe an example of the state of mind required to prove obstruction of justice?
Yeah, that's a good point. It is an easy one in the campaign violation. However, now we're back to the ultimate question. Can a sitting president be indicted? There is DOJ policy that answers that question, no. So while Attorney Cohen is fair game, and he's clearly in the sights of Mueller, I don't think the president can be indicted if you just look at the DOJ policy. So where this factors into, it factors into what ultimate report Mueller's going to give the deputy attorney general, which will then make its way to Congress, either a Republican Congress or a Democratic Congress. And that's going to be pivotal. But to your point, which is well taken, it's the cover up. It's the lies. Now, are we so, you know, immune to the lies coming from the White House? Not just this White House, right? Pick a White House. Politicians lying is hardly film at 11 kind of stuff. And, you know, and we were talking about this before, I don't think it really is going to move the needle too much. You know, a New York real estate developer lying, again, is not shocking. But where does it go and what else does Cohen know? That's really the important question, because there's no way it stops at this. We just got information that Cohen's phones were wiretapped. Very hard to get a wiretap of an attorney. Nearly impossible to get a wiretap of the president's attorney. They did not do that for a $130,000 campaign violation. No way.
So should we turn to the 48 questions?
Yeah, I mean, we should. I just want to help our listeners a little bit and help myself with something you just said, because to me this is fascinating, and you always sort of, you know, give us some of the inside scoop of what it's like to be, you know, at the highest levels of the federal, you know, prosecutor's office. You were an AUSA here in the Northern District. We've heard about the raid on Cohen's office. We've heard about the degree to which, you know, the government came in possession of lots of evidence. Some of it may be privileged. That's, you know, subject to the judge's ruling right now. Walk us through that and talk to us about what you have to show to a federal judge to get him or her to sign off on a warrant to go into an attorney's office and grab up this evidence. I mean, there's a high standard that you have to prove. Walk us through that. You know, how much evidence do you have to show?
Sure. And that's a good topic. You know, some people think that prosecutors or agents just wake up and on a whim they want to start knocking down doors. It doesn't happen that way. There's an internal process. And even though Mueller is not within a U.S. attorney's office, he's acting as if he is, appropriately so, because that's the process that's set up. So there is an internal process that he must show to get a search warrant, to use that as an example. The deputy attorney general signs off on all things critical, and this would obviously be a critical stage. So the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, signed off on that. Then it goes to a federal judge. We don't know if it was a Republican judge or Democratic judge. Doesn't matter. A federal judge who clearly saw enough in that affidavit to allow the agents to go in and seize an attorney's records. Much harder to get into an attorney's office than, you know, someone who's a plumber, because of a heightened level of attorney-client privilege. And again, the White House attorney makes, or the president's attorney, makes it even harder. So the evidence that was in that affidavit, which we may never see, clearly was enough that the judge signed off on it to allow them to go into his office, his home, and I believe his hotel room as well.
Which is unusual. I mean, it's unusual to go into an attorney's office and grab up this kind of evidence. It has to be a high level. I mean, there's got to be something there.
Logic would dictate that there is a lot there, not just one little case, but a plethora. There is a lot of information in that affidavit that a federal sitting judge would sign off on. So getting into a lawyer, and I've done two searches of lawyers' offices. Both times, they ended up being defendants. So, you know, as you know, there's an exception to the attorney-client privilege if they're committing a fraud. You don't get carte blanche for that. So logic would dictate that there was something pretty substantial in there.
So should we now turn to the 48 questions?
You know what? I love this stuff.
No,
this is my favorite
stuff too.
Topic.
I mean, eight to 10 minutes is not long enough. So let's talk about the 48 questions for a moment. Can you give us a quick highlight of what the different buckets are of topics that those 48 questions hit? And is he going to come in willingly, or is he going to be subpoenaed?
Yeah, buckets is the right way to look at it, because I look at it as different topics. Mm-hmm. You know, so you've got the straight, let's call it obstruction, which is the Flynn lying to the Flynn lying to the FBI.
Right.
So there they wanted to know, what did Trump know and when did he know it? If Flynn lied to the FBI about meeting with the Russians, that's one. If Trump knew he lied, two, and then wanted Comey to back off Flynn, 3 points. There is obstruction. If it was the governor of Illinois, he'd be rear cuffed by now. But mm-hmm. because it's the president, and I said before, it's a heightened scrutiny, and a sitting president might not be indicted, that's a problem. So one bucket is the obstruction. Another bucket tends to go to finances. And we saw an individual named Felix Slater and Cohen. That is Russian money, Russian involvement. Nothing to do with obstruction. Nothing to do with the election per se. We don't know. Slater was an individual who would get fairly wealthy individuals from the Eastern Bloc and put them into Trump buildings. So there's a lot of money coming from Mr. Slater. So that's another bucket.
And let me take a quick break. Can we Facebook Live this? Let's start doing that. Anyone object? Are you okay with that?
No, that's fine.
You guys?
Sure.
Are we okay with Facebook Living for a few seconds? All right, cool.
Sure.
All right, let's go.
And then, so the finances, you know, Trump Organization finances would be another bucket. And then there's different disparate questions, if you will, about his relationship with Sessions. Why was he so upset that Sessions was going to be recused? Why did he fire Comey? So you've got questions all over there, which still tend to go to an obstruction mentality. And keep in mind, too, these aren't questions that Mueller drafted and sent. It seemed to be notes taken maybe by one of Mr. Dowd, his former lawyer, and then, you know, circulated, leaked clearly, logic would dictate, by the White House or their attorneys. Robert Mueller did not leak these questions. That's absurd. So now you got at least a roadmap. If the president, when to get to your other question, will he go involuntarily? Now the president has a list of questions mm-hmm. that he can study if he was so inclined to actually sit down. The problem is, as you both know, it's not just the 48 questions.
Right.
Right. It's the follow-up.
Exactly.
So while he can knock it out of the park on one question, that's going to lead to five or six other questions that he's not scripted for. So that's the problem of walking him in. If you don't walk him in, let's go down that path mm-hmm. for a while. Bob Mueller doesn't just say, okay, I'll see you later. No, he gets a grand jury subpoena. Subpoenas the president. It's only been done once before with President Clinton, who was subpoenaed but then voluntarily went in.
Right.
Now it goes to the courts. Obviously, the White House would seek to quash that subpoena, and the federal courts, would deem whether a sitting president should take his time, because he's got to run the nation, theoretically,
yeah.
and sit into a grand jury. Now, you know, at the risk of being too flippant, this president does seem to watch a lot of television and comments. So he's got time in his hands, and he does work in his golf game fairly often. So, you know, he's got a day or two where he could probably go to the grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the battle that's coming.
What do you think? I mean, putting on your, you know, prognosticator hat, I mean, do you think he's going – it seems like he hired Giuliani to work out the parameters of the interview, not to come up with some plea, but as Giuliani said over the last couple of days, to come up with the, you know, what an interview looks like. I don't believe Mueller is going to, you know, give in to a lot of these demands. I don't think he's going to limit the questions to 3 hours max, is what Giuliani said. So I think ultimately the courts are going to have to be involved. As you mentioned, it's fairly, you know, new territory. Does this get to the Supreme Court? You know, we have Justice Kennedy maybe retiring. Does that – I mean, there's so many different, you know, elements in play here. It's amazing. I mean
– there are. If there is a grand jury subpoena, it absolutely gets to the Supreme Court, one side or the other. You know, the old phrase that we all utter, and it's quaint at this point, that no man is above the law. Well, we're going to put that to the test. And again, doesn't mean he's indicted. It just – can the president sit before grand jury? Should he spend that time? And we don't – no one, none of us want the president undergoing questions for 2 weeks. That's crazy.
Well, some of us might.
But 2 to 3 hours, as Giuliani mentioned, that's equally absurd.
It is absurd. Yeah. There's no way he's going to get through all this in 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah. No, I agree. The follow-ups alone
right.
Would take more time than that. The other thing, which is if he walks in voluntarily for an interview, he has his attorneys with him, who can stop the proceeding, pause, talk to their client. You know, they can do some damage control.
Mm-hmm.
You walk into a grand jury room, you are alone. Your lawyer is not there with you. That is also very pivotal. Because if the play here was President Trump, who has a challenge with the truth, and a federal prosecutor acting as a federal prosecutor, armed with documents and statements from witnesses and statements from cooperating witnesses, that ends poorly for the president. There's no way it doesn't.
But can you tweet from a grand jury room?
No.
Are you sure about that?
None of mine did, thankfully. No, phones are left outside.
Great stuff, as always. That's Jeff Cramer, Managing Director of BRG, Berkeley Research Group in Chicago. Always appreciate you coming on, Jeff. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks a lot.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Troy LaRavier joining us here on Legal Face-Off. Welcome, Troy.
Thanks for having me.
Troy, thanks for coming in. Tell us why you're running for mayor of Chicago.
Well, thanks. I'm running for mayor of Chicago because Chicago does not have a mayor. The bankers have a mayor. The investor class has a mayor. The real estate developers have a mayor. But everyday people, working people, do not have a mayor. They do not have a champion. They don't have an advocate. And I want to make sure they have one in City Hall. People like Henry Feinberg, he has a mayor. This is the venture capitalist who was caught in an email exchange with Rahm Emanuel trying to get him to push for to get rid of workers' pensions. Mm-hmm. And Rahm responds by bragging about the fact that he's the only mayor in the country who eliminated a benefit, got rid of their health care altogether, bragging about this, sent 10,000 city workers into poverty. Those 10,000 city workers don't have a mayor. Henry Feinberg has one. I want to give them and hundreds of thousands of people like them a mayor, or those kids at the National Teachers Academy. Once again, in an email chain, we found that there's a group called the Prairie Alliance, wealthy South Loop residents who wanted the National Teachers Academy building, a beautiful building occupied by low-income, mostly African-American students, one of the best schools in the city, has a 1-plus rating, it's fully enrolled, it doesn't meet any of the criteria for school closures. But he's closing that school down that's occupied by these low-income black and brown students so that he can give it to the wealthy residents of the South Loop because he's their mayor. He's the wealthy residents' mayor. He is not a mayor for those kids at the National Teachers Academy or the four Inglewood high schools that he's shutting down. They need a mayor, and I want to be their mayor.
So what do you think are the biggest issues that are confronting Chicago? Now, obviously, we've touched on the schools, we've touched on pensions. What do you think are the other big issues that the city is facing, and what would you like to do to address those issues?
Revenue and reform, particularly reform, corruption, basically, is the biggest issue. It's the one that prevents us from seriously dealing with all of the other ones. The fact that, again, those who are connected, those who are powerful, have influence and get to decide where our city tax dollars go, where our resources go, what problems are going to be addressed and which ones won't. That is the core of our problem. The fact that, for example, we paid $34 million. For a pre-K program that cost $17 million. Mayor took out a $17 million loan, and he's going to pay back the folks, the banks, $34 million. And here's the excuse he gave us. He said that if the pre-K kids, the kids who get pre-K, do better than the kids who don't get it, then we're going to double, you know, their return. And they call it pay for success. It's not pay for success. It's pay double for average. Kids who get pre-K, it's already proven that they do better than kids who don't get pre-K. That's like you getting a plumber, asking him how much is it going to be to redo your pipes. He says $10,000, and you say, I'll give you $20,000 if it doesn't leak. Who does that? Who does that with their own money? But he does that consistently with our own money. He's always prioritizing projects that take our tax dollars and send them towards his wealthy campaign contributors. The Tribune had a front page story. 60 of his top 100 campaign contributors all got some kind of contract or kickback or some kind of deal in return for their campaign contributions. He spends over half his days meeting with his donors. And as a result of the fact that they exercise so much influence, all of the other problems that we have to deal with, to getting back to your question, get neglected because we have a city hall. We have someone in city hall who is a mayor for a small class of people, but not for the rest of us. So I think that's the first one. I think the issue with police accountability is huge. Of course, as an educator, I believe the issue with our schools is huge. Our school system right here in Chicago, we are ranked 857th out of 858 school districts in the state of Illinois in the ratio of students to certified staff. What that means is that the average Illinois school with 600 kids has 58 professional educators to serve those 600 kids. Do you know how many professional educators serve 600 kids in Chicago? 37. 21 fewer, not 21 fewer than the top Illinois schools. We have 21 fewer staff than the average Illinois school. That is severe underinvestment in those students. Go ahead.
Just turning to a different subject, Troy, we found out yesterday that COPPA came out with a ruling in a shooting that was unjustified. They found that Officer Robert Realmo will face potential firing resulting from a fatal 2015 shooting of a teenager who was carrying a baseball bat. What are your feelings on how to deal with the issue of how the police are interacting with citizens of Chicago? Also, how will you deal with violence and gun violence in particular if elected mayor of Chicago?
So my approach to most issues is, what does the research say works? You know, even in education, where I'm an expert, we always go back to the research. What has worked nationally? What works locally? And in terms of gun violence, we start with the Department of Justice report. Right? They spent months, if not an entire year, following the CP around, going into the data. They came closer to the problems than any of us ever will. So let's take a look at what they found. And what they found was, number one, a pattern in practice of an unconstitutional use of force. Undeniable. Number two and three, which were basically implied recommendations, is that there are no accountability systems, no effective accountability systems whatsoever to hold officers accountable when they do use unconstitutional, when they do engage in an unconstitutional use of force. And three, and very importantly, is that there's a lack of training, a lack of supervision, and even more importantly, a lack of support. And when we say support, we're not talking about rah, rah, rah kind of support. We're talking about building their capacity to do their jobs correctly. And that's one of the things that gets missed in these accountability conversations. Even in schools, there's this teacher accountability conversation. We helped Blaine become the number one school in the city of Chicago, not because we led with accountability, but we led with capacity building. Building teachers' capacity to meet the expectations by which we were holding them accountable. And it's the same with police officers. We have to build their capacity to meet the expectations, to serve citizens respectfully, justly, fairly, to meet the expectations by which we hold them accountable. And when we attempt to build their capacity and they don't respond to that, there have to be accountability systems that say there are going to be consequences for violating the rights of our citizens. There are going to be consequences for treating citizens unfairly or treating our residents unfairly and unjustly.
So, why don't you share your thoughts? Obviously, immigration, very, very debated topic. Obviously, Chicago, sanctuary city, you know, hub of conversation about that. Why don't you share your thoughts on how you propose making Chicago a true sanctuary?
That's an excellent question. I think the examples of it all across our city, right after Trump got elected and instituted one of those travel bans, I went to a school on the north side. And, you know, the mayor talked about all this stuff about we're going to be a sanctuary city. But they showed what it's really like. They had an assembly where they talked about how welcoming their school was going to be in a very concrete way. They brought attorneys and advocacy groups in to talk to immigrant parents and families about their legal responsibilities, steps they should take in case they're pulled over or in case that they're taken into custody. That is support. They were out there in the school providing support and services to families, not just doing lip service about we're not going to cooperate with the police or with the feds if they ask us for anything, but they were taking steps, concrete steps to provide support for these families. But that was just that school. If we were truly a welcoming city, that would have been a citywide phenomenon. And things like that would have been a citywide phenomenon.
That is Troy LaRavier running for mayor. The website to learn more, troyforchicago.com. Troy, thanks for joining us. And when you get elected, you better come back.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Troy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and selected acted for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit DLAPiper.com.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff here on WGN. You can always follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, and we're on iTunes as well. You can find us and leave us a review. Joining us now on the phones, he's a professor of law at UCLA, also the author of the new novel, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Adam Winkler joining us here in Chicago. Hello, Professor.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Professor, in your new book, you talk about a couple hundred years worth of cases and the evolution of the corporate rights movement, which is how corporations have essentially been given increasing constitutional rights as if they were individual people. Can you explain for our listeners at a high level sort of what that evolution has looked like? And I know many folks think that that sort of culminated in the 2010 case of Citizens United. Can you give us sort of an overview of your book and that evolution?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, 2010, the Citizens United case really put a public spotlight, if you will, on the question of corporate personhood and constitutional protections for corporations. But the issue has really been a long-standing one, and Citizens United is really just the tip of the iceberg, the most visible manifestations of a much larger and largely hidden phenomenon, and that it turns out that corporations have been pursuing equal rights for over 200 years. And like women and like minorities, they have sought to gain a measure of equal citizenship. Unlike women and minorities, of course, corporations don't protest in the street and they don't risk their lives to gain equal rights. But nonetheless, corporations have fought in the Supreme Court to win landmark rulings extending our most fundamental constitutional protections to them since America's earliest days.
Professor, really fascinating, because reading parts of your book, as you point out, you know, this goes back, you know, to 1809. The first Supreme Court case on this issue was decided back then. And your book involves, you know, a cast of characters, everyone from Daniel Webster to Teddy Roosevelt, Ralph Nader, and even the you know, the most popular person now on the stage, Alexander Hamilton. Tell us why the corporate rights movement has been, you know, such an important part of American jurisprudence over all these years, because I think most people, myself included, thought that Citizens United was such a groundbreaking case because this was really the first instance of this movement. But tell us why, you know, it's really gone back that far.
That's right. I mean, the corporate rights movement has been very successful, and today corporations have nearly all the same constitutional protections as you and me, at least all the ones that a corporation might want. And that's the result of, really, like I said, this 200-year effort to win Supreme Court decisions. And it's had a really big impact on America. By corporations seek constitutional rights and use those rights to overturn laws that regulate business in the interest of consumers or investors or the public at large. And it's been going on for a long time. The first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans wasn't decided until 1857, and the first Supreme Court case on the rights of women wasn't decided until 1873. Those are the civil rights movements that we study when we think about the Constitution. But corporations have been doing it too, and indeed the first Supreme Court case on the rights of corporations was decided in 1809, a half century before the similar cases for African Americans and women. And so that corporate rights movement is worth some study as well.
Can you give us some detail as to, you know, maybe highlight a few of the cases and what the rights were that were afforded to corporations by virtue of those cases? And maybe for our listeners, you know, tell us where you think this is all headed, given where some of the issues have been coming up and are likely to come up in the next couple of years, particularly with the Supreme Court. You know, having the different justices that in the composition that we have now, what we can expect in the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, of course, we look back through the history. It's really a very rich history of Supreme Court cases. And one of the things that was really fun about my book, in terms of doing the research and writing my book, We the Corporations, is that I was able to go back and find all of these really sort of hidden, neglected landmarks of American law. That we all study, lawyers all study Brown versus Board of Education and Roe versus Wade and these major landmark decisions, but often don't look at those major landmark decisions that extend our most fundamental rights to corporations. And there are yet important cases. For instance, after the Civil War, when corporations sought rights under the 14th Amendment, rights of equal protection and due process, rights that were guaranteed to the newly freed slaves, but turned out to be used much more by business corporations in the first half century than it was by women or minorities. And the cases go through American history, through the trust-busting era of Teddy Roosevelt, through the rise of freedom of the press. We often don't think about it, but freedom of the press cases are often brought by business corporations. And in terms of where it's heading today or tomorrow with the Supreme Court, there's a major case currently pending before the court that could greatly expand the rights of business corporations. It's called Masterpiece Cake Shop, and it deals with whether a Colorado bakery can refuse to provide a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. And if the Supreme Court sides with the bakery, it could give businesses new license to discriminate.
Yeah, that was going to be my last question was, you know, your book talks about whether corporations have the same rights as people. Does that right extend to whether a business can decline to serve a customer based on its feelings about same-sex marriages? I mean, that's one of the key cases before the Supreme Court right now, and I think it's an extension of what, you know, your book looks at over the last couple hundred years.
That's right, and I think there's a pretty good chance the Supreme Court will rule in favor of the bakery in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. And one of the things I found is that it really shows that we've come very far in the corporate rights movement. 100 years ago, even though the courts were expanding the rights of corporations, they said there were some limits to those corporate rights. Corporations, the courts said back then, had property rights, but not liberty rights. They didn't have the rights associated with personal conscience or political freedom. And in fact, 100 years ago, I found a Supreme Court case where the court said that corporations do not have a constitutional right to refuse to do business with customers they didn't want to do business with, and that they had to respect anti-discrimination laws. It seems to be a lesson that today's Supreme Court may have forgotten.
Professor, I would be remiss if I did not bring up the fact that your father is the director of all the Rocky movies. We know Rich is the biggest movie nerd in the planet, and he can't wait to tackle some questions about Rocky here. Rich, I'll let you take it away, but I know you're amped here.
Well, to be clear, he was the producer, and he won the Best Picture for Rocky in 1976 when the professor was a young, soon-to-be expert on constitutional law. But, yeah, I mean, your dad, Irwin Winkler, really one of the legends of American cinema over the last, you know, half century or more, producer not just of the Rocky franchise, but of literally, you know, few dozen of the greatest films that have been produced, like I said, in the last 50 years, including many Robert De Niro movies. He did direct, started directing when? In the early 90s, I believe, and directed a lot of amazing films, including one that's incredibly underrated, in my opinion, Guilty by Suspicion. But, yeah, Professor, how often are you stopped to talk about your dad versus your We the Corporations book?
Well, I guess every once in a while, and it's always an honor to do so. You know, I had the good fortune to grow up in Hollywood and grew up on film sets and even starred in some movies, or at least had bit parts, I should say, in some movies when I was very young, including a movie I had a bit part in where I acted in a scene with Robert De Niro, directed by Martin Scorsese. And I kind of figured that was the pinnacle of my acting career, and so I had to find a different career. So I went into teaching.
What film was that?
That was a movie called New York, New York, and it was a musical that is widely forgotten these days.
It's De Niro was a saxophone player.
That's De Niro plays a saxophone player, and it was directed by Martin Scorsese. It was the kind of musical only Martin Scorsese could make. It was about a wife beater. And so it was an unusual movie, but it did have one lasting impact on American culture. It introduced the song New York, New York that Frank Sinatra later sang and made very, very famous.
And he literally wore a wife beater T-shirt in the whole film, if I recall.
No, that's right. Only Scorsese would make
that's
him
right.
a guy who beats his wife.
That's awesome. Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and the author of the new novel, check it out, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Thank you, professor, so much.
Thank you.
We roll along on Legal Face-Off here on WGN and WGNradio.com. There's a really cool documentary coming out on May 4th, which is Friday, RBG on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And we're happy to be joined by the co-directors of the documentary, Julie Cohen and Betsy West. Hello, welcome to WGN.
Thanks.
Hi there.
Happy to be here.
Betsy and Julie, we are so excited for this movie, not just as fans of all things legal here on Legal Face-Off, but as documentary fans. And I think just generally, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a phenomenal. I'll give you a quick story. I was sworn into the Supreme Court as part of my law school about a year ago this time. And as you probably know, that's, you know, it's a ceremony where lawyers get sworn in. And afterwards, we were hoping that a justice would come by. You know, they don't guarantee it, but they frequently do. And there was a bunch of us, probably 100 people in the room, friends and family. And the doors open, and guess who walks in but Justice Ginsburg? And literally, it was a combination of, like, Elvis and Madonna and every rock star you could imagine. You know, the small, diminutive woman walked in, and literally, like, the room went crazy. That is a phenomenon that you cover extensively in your movie, which I've seen some clips on and is amazing. Tell us why this 80-plus-year-old woman gets this kind of, you know, this fan base. People just freak out around her. Tell us why.
You know, this is Betsy. I think that a lot of people are really galvanized by some of the dissents that she's written, this very simple, strong language of speaking truth to power. The reason we wanted to do this documentary is that we know there's so much more to RBG. She has an extraordinary, both professional and personal story.
So what is she like personally? I mean, we're looking forward, obviously, to the documentary, and it's coming out imminently. But what do you think is the essence? I mean, obviously, she's a very strong, brilliant woman with just an amazing track record. What did you find particularly special about her that maybe not everyone would know about until they see the documentary?
Yeah, well, one of the great things about making this film was the chance to really get to see her up close and personal. She is a serious, reserved, and as you say, brilliant woman. But one of the really fun things that came through when we were making our film is that there's a really warm and really fun side to her, too. Not only will you see her kind of hanging out with her granddaughter in the movie, but also working out at the gym and even cracking up as she watches for the first time the Saturday Night Live impressions of her by Kate McKinnon.
Yeah, I think looking at some of the clips and, you know, again, what I've seen is really fascinating stuff. I think a lot of people now don't realize, you know, the degree to which Justice Ginsburg was really a strong advocate and really, you know, a trailblazer as an attorney. I think if I recall, she went, what, 5 of 6 before the Supreme Court?
Yeah, in the early 70s, you know, she had a very radical idea in the early 70s. It was that the U.S. Constitution should cover both men and women equally. And back in the early 70s, that really wasn't the case. And after she got through with her work, she really had changed the world for American women.
So what was the biggest thing that surprised you both about her in making the documentary that you learned along the way?
Well, you know, we learned a lot of stuff about her. Maybe the most surprising, when you think of this, you know, quite slim and teeny 85-year-old woman who, by the way, has survived cancer twice, maybe you don't picture someone who would be really into adventure, but we've got a great image of her in the film riding on an elephant with Justice Scalia, who was a very close friend of hers before he passed away. She likes to whitewater raft. She's gone parasailing. Like, we don't think people would expect that.
You mentioned her friendship with Justice Scalia, which has been the subject of, you know, over the last 20 or so years before Justice Scalia died. You know, it was the subject of a lot of discussion. A lot of people were fascinated by the fact that these polar opposites, when it came to their approach to the law, were such close friends. I know in the film, Justice Ginsburg talks about that and thinks it's really not as big a deal and not as surprising as a lot of people thought. Talk to that for a minute.
Yeah, I think that many people said to us, oh, that's just for show. They really weren't that good friends. But in fact, they were very close. We talked to Justice Scalia's son, who talked about how much they loved going to the opera together and how much they enjoyed, how much Justice Ginsburg enjoyed Justice Scalia's sense of humor. He was a very funny guy. And, you know, they really were intellectual equals. So even though they may not have convinced each other about their point of view, they liked sparring. They liked talking about it. They didn't have a problem with being friends with somebody who had a different opinion than they did.
So why do you think it's particularly important at this time to tell Justice Ginsburg's story? I mean, we're obviously in very turbulent political times. Where does this documentary fit into where we are today? And what are you hoping people will walk away with knowing and feeling?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a couple things that really feel relevant today. One is what Betsy was just talking about with the whole idea of being able to have a close friendship and reaching out to someone and really relating to someone whose ideological views are quite different from your own seems like a pretty good example that maybe it would be helpful if more people in and out of public life would take that position. You know, and then the other has to do with our renewed focus, which is, we think, a good focus on the kind of the place of women and the treatment of women in our society. Justice Ginsburg, as a young lawyer, really set a strong path and an example of what activism can be, how you can sort of work one step at a time strategically to enhance and improve the rights of women. And, like, that's an issue people are really looking a lot at today. Like, how can we do something? How can we make sure there's a more equitable situation for women in and out of the workplace?
You know, and Justice Ginsburg's approach was very steady, very determined, as she tells us, never in anger. You're just not going to convince people and to come to your table by yelling and screaming. She faced extraordinary challenges in her life, and she managed to think very strategically about how to attack them and how to convince people that her idea of the law regarding women was the correct one. I think she is a good role model for activists who are looking at the problems today.
Yeah, I love the part of the film, the parts of the film when you actually hear a younger Justice Ginsburg actually orally argue before the court. That part is amazing. Talk to us also about, in addition to the law, this other great love of her life being her marriage to Marty Ginsburg, who died of cancer in 2010. It's a major part of the film.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, Ruth and Marty Ginsburg had one of the great feminist love stories of all times. They met at Cornell University in the 1950s. It was a 4-to-1 ratio, male to female. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, as you'll see from the home movies in our film, was extraordinarily beautiful, really had her pick of men. Marty was the first one, she said, who cared that she had a brain.
He was the most supportive husband, and he bragged about his wife when they were in law school that she was going to make law review. And then when her work in the 70s took on so much importance, he was a lawyer himself, but he really took over a lot of the responsibilities at home. And he was a fabulous cook. He and the kids just kicked her out of the kitchen because she wasn't a good cook. And then he moved to Washington when she became a judge, and he was very instrumental in making sure that her name was considered, that she was considered when an opening came to the Supreme Court. I mean, you just can't get a more supportive husband than that.
You can learn more about the documentary, rbgmovie.com. RBG, the documentary, comes out Friday, May 4th, in 10 cities, including Chicago. Julie Cohen, Betsy West, the directors, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all.
We wrap it up, as we always do on Legal Face-Off, with the Legal Grab Bag. Seven topics today, Rich, Tina, and Sam. And the first one involves Stormy Daniels. Why not?
Of course, because
clear,
you know,
with a chance of stormy today.
Yes.
That is my prediction for the legal grab bag.
So, yes, the latest and greatest in the Stormy Daniels news is earlier this week, she filed a new lawsuit against President Trump, alleging that he defamed her in one of his tweets, no shocker there, regarding claims that she made about some alleged threats that she received back in 2011. So the story starts back in May of 2011 when Daniels had agreed to cooperate with In Touch magazine on an article that they were going to write about her alleged affair with President Trump back in 2006. Daniels alleges that a few weeks later, she was approached and threatened in Las Vegas parking lot. Sam, I don't know if you see any suspicious activity like this in your neck of the woods these days.
But she
claims that she was approached and threatened by a man in a Las Vegas parking lot who demanded that she leave the president alone and forget the story. She claims then that the mystery man looked at her infant daughter who was in the back seat of her car and said, "That's a beautiful little girl. It would be a shame if something happened to her mom." So as it turns out, In Touch magazine never ran the story. Daniels' suit alleges that the magazine chose not to run the article after it had contacted President Trump for comment and was threatened to not run the story. So Daniels had released a sketch of the man who allegedly threatened her back in April. And Trump then responded on April 18th with a tweet saying, "A sketch years later about a non-existent man, a total con job playing the fake news media for fools, but they know it." So the lawsuit alleges that the president's tweet falsely attacks her account of the threatening incident and that the president knew that his false and disparaging statement would be read by millions of people and that she would be subjected to threats of violence and economic harm and reputational damage.
Well, it still goes on, right? Because Trump, as of 5:54 a.m., as we talked about with Kramer earlier, tweeted this morning that the Giuliani revelation that the $130,000 was actually a payoff is complete nonsense, and Trump has responded. Trump has continues to attack Stormy Daniels. He said this morning that the agreement was used to stop the false and extortionist accusations made by her, meaning Stormy, about an affair. So this continues. I'm sure his attorney is going to add these tweets onto the lawsuit that he's filed. I mean, I think Stormy Daniels has a lot, you know, this lawsuit has a lot more legs today than it did when she filed it, because
right,
we now know that Trump was lying when he said that, when he called her a con job. I mean, what
right,
she said was true, that the money was in exchange for her keeping silent about the affair. So, man, this stuff continues. It's fun. By the way, in his tweet, he misspelled the word role. He said, he ends the tweet, the third tweet, he says, "Money from the campaign or campaign contributions played no role in this transaction."
Did he
R-O-L-L. Like what, a Vienna roll or onion roll? Or
that's how he rolls.
Maybe a croissant? It played no croissant in this transaction. Come on. You're the president. Use the word roll.
Let's keep
correctly.
Keep the lawsuit conversation moving. A new lawsuit involving Harvey Weinstein, and this one pretty serious. They all are, of course, but this involving a pretty popular actress.
Well, very, very interesting lawsuit, because it's the first time really that alleged victims of Harvey Weinstein are alleging actual economic loss, right? Until now, the accusers have said that there has been damage to their reputations, that they have been harassed, that they have been subject to unwanted sexual acts, which is all incredibly serious, all incredibly, you know, terrible. Now, for the first time, Ashley Judd was saying that she lost work because of it. She lost actual roles. She says in her lawsuit that was filed Monday that she was basically blacklisted by Hollywood because Harvey Weinstein told people not to cast her because she wouldn't have sex with him. And she gives a specific example of a film. Lord of the Rings came out in 2001. Peter Jackson is the director, and that was incredibly successful movie, led to billions of dollars in the franchise. I think one of the sequels is one of the top 10 grossing films of all time, the third one. So, you know, considerable amount of damages. Peter Jackson has actually admitted in December, said that he removed her from the casting list for Lord of the Rings as a direct result of what he thought was accurate, which is now false information by Weinstein. Weinstein told Peter Jackson, allegedly, that Miss Judd was a nightmare to work with, who should be avoided at all costs. So, you know, for the first time, and what will inevitably be a series of additional lawsuits, someone is coming forward to say, not only did Harvey Weinstein damage me psychologically, not only did was I subject to unwanted sexual advances, but I actually lost money and suffered damages to my career as a result of it. We're going to see other actresses. Mira Sorvino has alleged similar allegations. Annabella Ciora has said that she did not work from 1992 to 1995 because of the Harvey Weinstein machine. So this is the first of many lawsuits. I think it has a lot of legs. I think that it's going to be, you know, successful. And it's a really interesting legal development.
You've said it has a lot of legs, like twice down the last 5 minutes.
I did, yeah. Not purposely.
Roy Moore ran for U.S. Senate and failed in Alabama, and now he's moving on to a defamation suit against four accusers.
More defamation. Roy Moore, who, of course, lost the Alabama Senate campaign after accusers claimed he pursued inappropriate relationships with them when they were teenagers. Another woman claimed that he groped her when she was leaving his office in 1991. He lost his campaign for Senate. As I mentioned, he has now turned around and sued these women, claiming that they defamed him. He is alleging in a state court filing this week in Alabama that they conspired to ruin his Senate campaign. He alleges that all of these allegations, of course, are false, and that they conveyed false and malicious information to newspapers. Of course, the accusers have now come out and said that they stand by the veracity of their accusations, and that his pursuit of them actually occurred, and they have reaffirmed all of it. So, you know, Roy Moore going on the offensive, I think it's, you know, going nowhere. The ultimate defense, of course, to any defamation suit is that the allegations are true.
Well, and I thought when we were covering this story months ago when it first broke, that it was pretty clear. I mean, there were so many people who came out and said that it was pretty well known for a long time that he did this. Wasn't he banned from like every shopping mall in America?
Yeah, he was. Well, he was definitely banned from the malls that he was stalking these women at. You know, a truly desperate move. I think if I was Roy Moore's attorney, I would say, you know, cut your losses, go away. Maybe people won't remember you as much as they will now. But, you know, by filing a lawsuit, he thinks he's pulling a Trump. Remember, Trump said that when these accusers, I think there was, you know, almost 15 of them before the election, he said, oh, I'm going to sue each and every one of them for defamation. I've yet to see any of those filings. So, you know, it's a page out of the Trump notebook.
All right. How about paramedics versus Chicago Fire Department? What do we have here?
So, yes, our uplifting stories continue. On Tuesday of this week, five female Chicago paramedics filed suit against the city. Their lawsuit alleges in pretty significant detail the claims of five Jane Doe paramedics who claim they were forced to endure repeated sexual misconduct and gender discrimination by numerous superiors at the Chicago Fire Department. The suit claims that the city failed to deter this longstanding pervasive culture of sexual misconduct and that the men accused of wrongdoing were allowed to remain on the job while their accusers were often put on medical leave. Among those who were accused are the field commander and ambulance commander, both of whom were the subject of numerous allegations. The suit also claims that these conditions were exacerbated by the city's failure to provide basic equal treatment for the women, including their failure to provide adequate bathrooms and separate sleeping quarters. There was actually a count in the complaint about one particular Jane Doe plaintiff about her being approached when she was trying to sleep and one of these men coming into her room, and she actually was worried that she was going to be attacked. The alleged wrongdoings included, in addition to that, included everything from sexually explicit remarks by superiors to explicit texts, inappropriate questions about underwear and marital relations, threats of termination for complaining about inappropriate behavior, and unwanted physical contact and sexual advances. The five plaintiffs were listed as Jane Doe's in the complaint because they want to remain as employees and just want to get relief from the what they term the current hostile work environment.
Yeah, one of the most shocking parts of this story is that one of the women filed a complaint with the city, with Chicago's Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the body charged with investigating these kind of complaints. And according to the allegation, when investigators from that office interviewed her several months later, they actually threatened her. They said that you are subject to discipline for failing to disclose the name of a friend that she had told about this abuse. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
No,
so she goes, she pursues the appropriate avenue, which is the, you know, Equal Opportunity Office. And they go after her saying that unless you disclose this person's identity that you talked to, that you confided in, we're going to discipline you. I mean,
it's crazy
nuts,
stuff.
Bananas. You can't make it up.
How about this case out of Utah where a lawyer missed a deadline by 18 minutes but got an extension because of a basketball game? This is ridiculous.
This is up your alley, Sammy.
I love it.
This is another one for the books. So a Salt Lake City lawyer recently received an extension from a federal judge in Utah when he claimed that he filed a legal brief 18 minutes late due to the adverse emotional impact of a loss in the playoffs by Utah Jazz.
Stop it. Just stop it. The dumbest reason I've ever heard for being late.
But you know what? I'm going to remember this in case I ever need to pull this one up.
The judge bought it. The judge bought it.
The judge bought it. And an opposing counsel bought it, too. Said, oh, you know, and an opposing counsel from Dorsey and Whitney in Minneapolis who said, well, for all practical purposes, I'm a Jazz fan too. So,
by the way, I wonder if it's because this guy happens to be the minority leader of the Utah House of Representatives.
I don't know.
No small favors there.
I was going to say, you know, I'm sure that's not a coincidence. So the lawyer, Brian King, and this is, again, you can't make this stuff up, filed a motion for an extension of a deadline that was on April 25th when he took a break from work on his legal memo to watch Game 5 of the Utah Jazz and the Oklahoma City Thunder. His memo was due at midnight, and when the Jazz lost not only their 25-point lead in the third quarter, but they totally lost the game, King claims that the emotional effect of the loss was, quote, to say the least, dispiriting. The pallor cast on counsel's mind eventually led to submission of a written product that was twice as long and half as strong as it would have been had the Jazz emerged victorious, as well as 18 minutes tardy. He also said, quote, foreseeable but unwished for circumstances, together with unforeseen emotional impact from those circumstances, constitute good cause for this motion.
Come on, stop it. I just have to say stop it. I mean, this is why people hate lawyers. This should be exhibit A as to why you hate lawyers. I mean, I know the guy is trying to be like cutesy and funny in this writing, but just stop it. I mean, this guy should have been this motion should have been thrown out, and this guy should have been barred from presenting this memo. I mean, he should have lost because of that. You know, I mean, to say that you were watching, I mean, I know it's funny, but you know,
no,
watching,
it's pathetic.
It's completely nuts. And by the way, it's the Utah Jazz. Who gives a crap about the Jazz anyway? Sam?
But doesn't this set a bad, it sets a bad precedent going forward, doesn't it? Because now other lawyers can refer to this going forward, can't they? Oh, well.
Yeah. I was watching the, the Cubs game. That's why I couldn't get to the memo. All right. You know, it was a
the
very.
The Blackhawks. They broke my heart.
Come on. Nonsense. Go away, Mr. King.
There has been another retirement.
Jazz, prospects for the Utah Jazz. Looking pretty good. Young
team. I like the Jazz.
Mitchell?
Jazz are good, yeah. Donovan Mitchell's a really good player. The problem is they're going to have to hope that Houston misses a lot of threes like three more times, and I don't know if that'll happen.
Yeah. And Karl Malone's having a good series, right?
John Stockton, too.
Yeah, for sure.
There has been a retirement of another...
Not Byron, but
another
Brian.
American... this is... we're going to have to clean this up.
No, it's good, man. Keep rolling. Let's go.
No, I just... I'm trying to go. What do you mean?
I'm just throwing 90s era Utah Jazz at you.
There's been another retirement of an American Indian mascot Greg following Ostertag. A debate over at Maine West High School.
Okay, guys, we have to be serious about this story. So news outlets reported this week that Maine West High School here in good old Chi-Town has ended its tradition of having an American Indian-themed mascot perform at football games and pep rallies. This decision came several weeks after some American Indians objected to the use of the image of the mascot on social media. These objections then led to a real firestorm on social media that injected Maine West into what has become a longstanding debate about the use of these types of mascots. The school actually had this mascot since it opened its doors in 1959, and up until now has largely escaped the same types of criticism that persuaded schools and universities such as U of I to drop similar mascots amidst the outcry from numerous American Indian nations as well as advocacy groups, with claims that use of such a mascot is culturally insensitive and has been shown to harm the self-esteem of young American Indians. A spokesperson from the high school said that school administrators considered the feedback that they received from a bunch of different people, including students, alumni, and members of the community, and that the decision to change the mascot was in an effort to demonstrate that it was never the school's intention to be offensive or disrespectful. The school is still currently trying to figure out what its new mascot and logo will be. Apparently, not everyone agrees with the decision. There were some alumni that were interviewed by various news sources who said that they believe that the mascot embodied noble qualities and was not meant to be offensive.
Sam, what's the current state of public perception for these kind of mascots? I mean, the Illini are still using their mascot. The Redskins are still using their name. But generally, I think these are, a dying breed, this use of these kind of mascots.
They have been phased out for sure. And while they still use the Illini, they have disbarred Chief Illiniwek, right? They don't have Chief Illiniwek anymore. They don't do the dance at halftimes of the football basketball games. But on the other side of that coin, in Atlanta, they still do the tomahawk chop, right? And they still, at Florida State, they throw the spear down at center field. So, I mean, you pick and choose your battles here, but you're right. They've totally started to phase the American Indian mascots out of sports.
True enough.
All right, last topic here on the Grab Bag. John DeLorean, the estate of John DeLorean, has sued over Back to the Future royalties.
Yeah, finally, a Back to the Future story I've been waiting for.
The king of the movie pod now reporting on Back to the Future.
John DeLorean's widow is suing to try to get some money for use of the famous car. The Sally DeLorean has sued the DeLorean Motor Company in the past over intellectual property rights. She settled back in 2015. Her husband, John DeLorean, who was the inventor of the car used in the film, he died back in 2005. The settlement allowed the motor company to use the name DeLorean without further challenge from the company, but it didn't deal with some other residuals from the movie. Now she's back in court looking for more money. She's now claiming, despite the fact that they settled and they had an agreement, the ultimate last desperate attempt in any lawsuit, which is called unjust enrichment, which is basically like, yes, we have a contract, but I really want more money. It's really not fair. When you see unjust enrichment, it's truly the bastion, the last, hope of any litigant. But more importantly, it brings me to the question of some Back to the Future trivia here.
Yes.
Sam, how's your Back to the Trivia knowledge? Back to the trivia. Back to the Future knowledge.
I'm okay. Yeah? I'm okay.
Are you a one, two, or three? Got to go with the original.
Oh, the
right?
First one for sure.
Yeah,
first one. Yeah,
second one was okay. The second one was okay.
Wasn't
portended
nearly as good
the Cubs' success, right? Remember when Marty picks up that book? It says Cubs World
Series.
Yeah,
the Sports Almanac.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Favorite Back to the Future movie?
First one. Yes, and I remember that Huey Lewis in the News like completely took off because
great
they had
song,
two songs,
Power
two
of
songs,
Love.
Power of Love, and then also Back in Time.
Back in Time for sure. Nice recall of Huey Lewis music from back in the day. Will they ever do a four? Is the question. Back
I don't
to the
know.
Future
wasn't
part
there some
four.
Talk about it for a while?
Yeah, I didn't love the third one. The third one was the Western.
Wasn't that
right?
With Mary Steenburgen?
Mary Steenburgen was, in fact, in the last two. And the great Doc Brown, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Well, play us out, Sam, with some Back to the Future music.
Power of Love.
Well, I would just like to say that old Biff Tannen is one of the ugliest villains in the history of cinema.
McFly, are you there, McFly?
Hello, McFly.
Hello.
A little too close to home for Sam, I think, back when he was a high schooler. Were you the Biff or the McFly?
I was McFly, for sure. I had a hoverboard.
Yeah, for sure.
For Rich Lightcoff and Tina Martini, my name is Sam Panionovich. Thanks to Ben Anderson for producing this show. We will talk to you next time on WGN. It's Legal Face-Off.